Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us a very special guest on the phone with us from Cologne, Germany. His name is one that might be familiar to listeners of ID the Future and people who follow intelligent design. He is Wolf Eckhard Lohnig, a geneticist who recently retired from the Max Planck Institute for Plant Breeding Research in Germany. So, Dr. Lohnig, we're very, very thankful to have you on the show with us today.
Very nice. Thank you very much for inviting and having me.
Well, I think it's long overdue that we've never had you on the show before, and I hope that this is not the last time. The occasion for bringing you on the show with us today, of course, Dr. Lohnig, is your new book that you published over the last couple months titled The Evolution of the Long-Necked Giraffe. And it's a wonderful book. I've been looking through it over the last couple days, and it covers a wide variety of issues related, of course, to the evolution of the long-necked giraffe and some of the problems that face its Darwinian evolution. As many of our listeners are aware, the long-necked giraffe has been an issue that many Darwinian evolutionists have talked about. And in your book, Dr. Lohnig, you talk about some of those people. So who are some of the Darwinian evolutionists who have commented on the evolution of the long-necked giraffe?
Well, during the last years, especially Richard Dawkins, and there's also Jerry Coyne, Neil Chubin, Matt Ridley, and others. And they have commented on the giraffe, and they have used it as a proof. And they seems to have been quite successful because their listeners do not know much about the giraffe. And it is so easy to grasp that during a giraffe like to eat the last leaves to survive. And so it is rather plausible to many of the listeners. It's also a school textbook example for many years in almost any textbook here in Germany and probably also in the US. The giraffe is mentioned as a good example of adaptation to special environmental situations like dearths.
So this has almost become an icon of evolution as an argument for Darwinian theory, it sounds like. I think you're right, actually, because there are textbooks that discuss this matter, and I can even think of a couple biology textbooks that have the long-necked giraffe on their cover as sort of an icon of evolution. So I think you're absolutely right, Dr. Lohnig. This is a very important issue. What did some of the Darwinian evolutionists say as to whether the long-necked giraffe provides a good example of Darwinian evolution?
As I just mentioned, it seems to be so self-evident that it is an adaptation to a certain environmental condition, especially in times when there's not enough green leaves for the animals. And so they think and they argue that there's an adaptation to the special environmental conditions.
It makes very much sense as an argument that they would want to understand how did it get the ability to reach the leaves at the top of the trees. Obviously, if the long-necked giraffe did evolve from some other shorter organism, then the argument is that there had to be these intermediate stages going from a shorter-necked giraffe-like creature to the long-necked giraffe. So you discuss this in your book somewhat. How many intermediates should there be in terms of evolving from a shorter creature to the long-necked giraffe? And what does the fossil record show? Does the fossil record show those intermediates?
Well, there's a rather recent paper by several researchers, and they have provided two different scenarios. One is the scenario of continuous evolution, the Darwinian evolution by small steps, which can hardly be seen, so small they are envisioned. And they have made calculations that there are about 500,000 generations from small giraffe-like animals to a larger one. The Latin name is Paleotragus primaevus and Paleotragus germanus. These are Latin pronunciation of the word. I do not know the English pronunciations. Well, 500,000 generations. And the question is that per generation 0.72 to 1.19 μm per generation. Well, and one may ask the question, are there really decisive selective advantages for the survival of giraffe populations of about 1/1000000th of a meter or a thousandth of a millimeter higher in each generation to reach the top of the trees and get the last leaves. In the other scenario, this is the idea, the microevolutionary scenario, with a series of adaptive morphological changes in response to climatic and vegetative variation during the Miocene. That's the quotation directly. And the other is the punctuated equilibrium. And in that scenario, think about between 2,000 and 3,300 generations. And they think that in this scenario, we have 143.1 to 238.5 mu meter generation. But again, the question, of course, are there actually decisive selective advantages for the survival of giraffe populations of about 0.2 millimeters higher in each generation, and that for about 3,000 generations or so? And this is only half of the whole story, because this is only the difference between the two short-necked giraffe species, Paleotragus primavus and Paleotragus germani. And from the latter one, Paleotragus germani, to Giraffa camelopardalis, you can double all these numbers. And then you have, on this background, some 3,000 to 500,000 giraffe generations. The reasons for doubling them I have given in that book in detail, because, in my view, they have not considered the difference correctly between Paleotragus germani and the long-necked giraffe. It's a short-necked giraffe and the long-necked giraffe, although that Paleotragus germani has a longer neck than the Paleotragus primavus, and it is about the size of an okapi. So the difference between an okapi and the long-necked giraffe would necessitate a large number of further generations, just double these numbers, and then question again, are there really decisive selective advantages for the survival of giraffe populations of about one millionth of a meter or a thousandth of a millimeter higher in each generation, and that for about 1 million generations? And for the punctuated equilibrium scenario, one may double this number again. This would mean about 6,000 generations, each generation of about 0.2 millimeters higher in each generation. Well, according to my understanding, my completely unbiased understanding, I would say this is really not very convincing, to put it very mildly.
That's very interesting, Dr. Loenig. What about the okapi? They're beautiful animals. I remember seeing them at the San Diego Wild Animal Park, but they're definitely not giraffes, although some people, and I believe Richard Dawkins was one of them, has cited them as sort of an intermediate or something that looks like a potential ancestor to the long-necked giraffe. So what are some of the differences between the neck of the okapi and the elongated neck of the giraffe?
Before I say something about that, I would like to point out that the fossil record poses important problems for these evolutionary scenarios. Because if you need, as I just quoted, according to evolutionary authors who stipulated these numbers themselves, we have only three or four so-called missing links, which in fact, on closer inspection, only short-necked or middle-necked giraffes, like the okapi, which you have just mentioned, but a continuous series of the enormous numbers which I have just quoted is really not in the fossil record. And I made a calculation some years ago what we have, how many genera of the extant living mammals have been found and recorded in the fossil record, and about half of the genera have already been recorded. That would mean 100% you would have to double it. And if you double these so-called missing links, you will never get a continuous series of evolutionary links from an okapi-like animal to the long-necked giraffe. And you ask a question concerning the okapi. There are many differences between okapi and the long-necked giraffe. The size, for example, you'll find in my book how the okapi is represented in the books of Richard Dawkins, for example. And they are drawn much greater than in reality they are. And this is a very strange method to try to convince the public with pictures which are not correct. The okapi has larger ears than the giraffe, And on the other hand, if you have, just to compare these two species, has larger eyes, which are located more laterally, as one author says, thus providing a good field of vision. Well, the giraffe's horns are unique. They are present in both sexes. In the okapi, it is only in the male sex. The horns appear in the giraffe at birth. They are covered with skin and hair throughout their entire life, except older males, which have rubbed off the skin of the tip, the horns. In the okapi, horns occur only in the males, and they are devoid of skin at the tip, and they are not present at birth. Giraffes are unable to swim, and the okapi has interdigital glands. Giraffes don't have such glands. Giraffes lack the cuticular muscles and therefore are unable to move the skin to discourage insects. So the giraffe has many different morphological and anatomical features compared to the okapi. The adult okapi is about 1.7 meters tall, and, well, you know, the giraffe can reach almost 6 meters. This, of course, makes necessary a lot of special physiological and anatomical adaptations. If the blood pressure must be extremely high to force the blood up its long neck, it has a systole of about 340 and a diastole of about 230. Now, a human being would certainly faint if it had a continuous high blood pressure. And that's, of course, why the giraffe requires a very strong heart, which weighs more than 10 kilograms, and the diameter of the walls is about 8 centimeters. When the giraffe lowers its head to eat or drink, rather recent measurements, it was about 350 millimeter HG. The arterial walls must be much thicker than normal. And there are many other points which could be mentioned. The large volume of air in the trachea, and that air is unavailable for respiration. And some people say if we had a dead volume of about 2.5 liters, that would be very dangerous for us. That's why the giraffe takes about 20 breaths per minute. A man has only 12, an elephant has 10. And it is a heartbeat. I have checked today, the value was given of 107 heartbeats per minute. So it's very fast if that value is correct. Many muscles, tendons, bones had to be modified accordingly if you compare it and want to derive it from a okapi-like animal. And there are also the strong blood pressure, which is usually about twice as much as in human beings in the arteries. One must differentiate between the systole and the diastole of the heart, and the blood pressure to the brain when the giraffe lowers its head. And the normal blood pressure is about twice as high as in human beings. So to prevent profuse bleeding in the legs, all the arteries and veins in the giraffe's legs are very internal. The red blood cells are about one-third of the size of human counterparts. Well, ontogeny in birth is modified. Now, if you ever have seen how a giraffe baby is born, that's almost from a height of 2 meters, the young one must fall to the ground and take something like a normal human being as well. It's not easy to survive such situations. So it has this thick skin which tightly stretches over the body and which functions like an anti-gravity suit worn by pilots of fast aircraft. So the entire structure of the giraffe is different in almost all respects. Well, giraffe also is a living fossil, and it is dated to be about at least 12 million years old, and it is appearing abruptly in the fossil record. Even some French biologists pointed out that the earliest giraffes were even bigger than ours, which we have today. That means probably more than 6 meters in height. It was about 10 to 12 million years, but then it was redated because I would surmise it didn't fit in the evolutionary scheme of things.
Dr. Lohnig, I'd like to return to the specialized features that you discussed, yes, which allow the giraffe to lower its head to drink water.
Yes.
And obviously you mentioned many, many features which seem like they are necessary simply to allow a giraffe to drink water. So is this the kind of system that could evolve in a step-by-step fashion through Darwinian evolution, or do you have to have lots of components and systems present all at once in order for this to work.
The point is, you cannot, as was suggested by Richard Dawkins, simply stretch out the neck during an embryonic deviation and then have a long-necked giraffe. You have a system of co-adapted, coordinated parts which all must work together to allow a giraffe to survive and live in the wild. And the question is, of course, can mutations produce in a gradual scenario over millions of years these differences between a short-necked and a long-necked giraffe? I may repeat, you cannot simply stretch the neck out a bit, say from 1.7 meters to almost 6 meters, but you have to adjust all organs, all systems, from blood pressure to heart to the lungs to the heartbeat and what have you. And it is simply naive to speculate that a large mutation, macro mutation, could produce in one step or only a few steps a long-necked giraffe from a short-necked. As a mutation geneticist, I have seen so many mutations, and there are also mathematical calculations which are fully in accord with what I have found on the field by studying more than 2 million plants, and we have also in my group sequenced several genes to know what has happened on the gene mutation level. And what you usually have is that you have a stop codon or a deletion, and you do not have an entirely new sequence. And there are many open questions, of course. How many new sequences, how many new gene differences or sequence differences? These are open questions. And I have a chapter about the intelligent design hypothesis, how it could be viewed from this standpoint and how research could go on from that standpoint concerning the question whether ID, for example, is really testable. The mutations which we know usually destroy a gene function or lower a gene function, but it does not produce entirely new gene functions. Even gene duplications. Michael Behe has, in his books, discussed these questions. I myself have discussed it, by the way, also of the annual reviews of genetics article, to simplify things in a way which is not correct anymore. And to resort to these kinds of mutations, which we know, and which we have studied, which we have sequenced, the DNA sequences, which we know due to mutations, to expect that you could produce an entirely new coordinated system of organs and organ functions to produce an entirely new animal like a long-necked giraffe. Well, but it's belief, it's faith, not science.
Well, Dr. Lohnig, I think we're running out of time for this first podcast, but I completely agree with you that when these evolutionary scientists don't have evidence, and in spite of the evidence, they continue to believe that this magnificent creature evolved in a step-by-step fashion, that certainly does qualify with faith. So stay tuned to ID the Future for more with Dr. Wolf Eckhard Lohnig on his new book, The Evolution of the Long-Necked Giraffe, What Do We Really Know? Testing the Theories of Gradualism, Macromutation, and Intelligent Design. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.